Hey, this is Scott Love, host of NALP Talk. Thanks for joining us. I have with me right now, Nakaya Gray, Executive Director of NALP, talking about conferences. Nakaya, thanks for joining me again on the show.
Scott, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell us about the 2024 conference in Boston.
You know, it was such a fantastic event. It was 3 days of over 90 concurrent sessions, multiple plenary speakers. It was the largest NALP conference ever with over 1,800 attendees, and the energy was just fantastic.
Yeah, lots of hugs. Lots of hugs.
Lots of hugs.
That's great. That's great. Who do you think made a contribution there? Who's kind of top of your mind for those people that you think contributed the most to the conference, even though I know a lot of people did?
So certainly the NALP volunteers. I mean, Sabelle Smith, who is our chair of conference planning this past year for the Boston conference, did just a fantastic job. And her whole team in picking out the educational sessions, planning all of the logistics of the conference, they did just a fantastic job. And of course, then there was many, many fantastic speakers there that contributed their time to making that event such a success. We had Jeffrey Canada, who gave a plenary talk. He's the president of the Harlem Children's Zone, and he just really gave this stirring talk about why we need to continue to fight for social and economic justice after the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision. So he's just one of those big highlights that stand out to me, and there were just so many of those.
That's great. Well, tell us about the 2025 conference, Nakaya.
Yes, we're really excited for that. The 2025 conference will be April 8th through 11th in Cleveland, Ohio. In fact, last month, we actually all met there. The conference planning team this year met there, and we really hashed out all of the educational programming and what we wanted that conference to be. We also got a sneak peek at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is where our members' education is going to be. So we are just getting really excited for that event.
I'm excited about that also. And speaking of Sabelle Smith, we're going to hear from her shortly, talking about her experiences in managing the conferences. And then after that, we're going to hear from one of the top-ranked speakers of the 2024 conference, Kara Hardin. Nakaya, thanks again for joining me, and I'm sure we'll be talking again real soon.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Hey, this is Scott Love. I've got Sabelle Smith with me right now, and we're talking about the 2024 conference. Sabelle, thanks for joining me on the NALP Talk podcast.
It's my pleasure.
And so you're the chair of the conference, 2024, Boston, Massachusetts. Let me ask you this. Let me start with this. What did you learn in putting this conference together?
Thanks for asking, Scott. There's so many things that could be learned from the conference planning experience. What I learned this time, since I've had the pleasure of doing this in the past, is the level of talent amongst our members is so deep. We were blessed with over 200 RFPs, and we had to cull that down into 90 programs. And so finding out the vast array of experiences and expertise that our membership has, and that they're so willing to come forth and present to their peers, is one of the favorite things that I've learned through the years about NALP and the conferences.
Yeah, and there's a lot of sessions during this conference.
That's right. We have 90 concurrent sessions, two plenaries, and the membership celebration, which will happen later tonight.
That's great. And so kind of walk it back a little bit. What happens in the beginning days when you send out the RFP, you make the announcements via email? What's kind of the typical process of what happens when you get those, and how do you decide?
Well, it's a long process. We're currently accepting applications for the Cleveland conference, which will happen next year. And folks are able to send in their RFP ideas. They will become a big, very large binder of materials, which the conference planning team will read through and meet in June in Cleveland. And they will go through and try to make a mixture of all the different tracks that we have for different areas of interest for our membership. And then we will piece together all those to bring it together and do a full plate of probably 90 to 95 plenaries.
Wow. And so what are the different categories of those tracks? How do you segment those?
Well, I mean, our membership is involved in a variety of different things at their employers. We have school side folks and law school folks, and we also have public interest employers and others. So we have tracks that would be appealing for folks who are beginners in the middle of their career or experienced professionals. And each of those could be things from diversity. We do PD, recruiting. The law school folks have counseling, things that they can do. And it's just whatever is the new trends. We have outside speakers talking about wellness and neurodiversity, just a wide variety of things amongst those 90 programs.
Yeah, that's great. That's a lot of moving parts. Who were some of the people that helped you putting that all together?
Right. This does not happen in a vacuum. This is a combination of an elected and appointed folks who comprise the annual education conference planning team and the very expert advice and help of the NALP staff, including Mary Beal and Megan Hagner and Jay Richards.
Yeah. And so how long did it take for everybody to go through these and to really decide on the finalists of the presentation?
Well, we all come with sections that we have to present on, and then we spend about 2.5 days on the ground in the conference facilities in June prior to the conference. So hours and hours and hours, and then following up with speakers and tweaking the different programs so that we have the best program we can have for the membership.
That's great. And let me ask you, tell me about your other experience that you've had in working with our trade association for putting conferences together.
Well, I have had the pleasure of being the membership director for NALP, and also I've been appointed and elected to this position. So I think this is my 6th or 7th conference that I've been involved in planning. And it's funny because the first time I did this, I said, gosh, this is the most fun thing I think I could ever do. I would do this every year if you let me. And much probably to the chagrin of many people, I've been able to do this a lot of times, and I really, really enjoy it. It's amazing, the volunteerism, and then to see everyone come back here and reconnect once a year at our sort of premier event is awesome.
That's great. Does it get easier each year?
You know what? It's different every time, and the groups are different. The dynamics are different. I would say it gets easier to kind of say, like, oh, this would be the time we should be doing the marketing for this, or this would be the time when we are pushing this out to the membership. And I just, you know, have had that experience to do this so many times. But overall, I would say it's different because the people and the programming and the trends change.
Yeah, that's right. And so do you ever look at other associations to get ideas for what you're going to be talking about within NALP?
You know, I'm sure that our members do because they're involved in other things based on their, you know, day jobs, so to speak. I have not, because I think, you know, we get so much content just from our membership that we don't really have to go outside and create too many other programs because they're bringing what is relevant to them in their day jobs and then sharing.
Yeah.
And that is a really wonderful thing about our membership. Even though in some ways we're competitors, we share a lot of information and a lot of best practices with each other.
That's right. And as I was looking at the agenda for the conference the other day, if I wanted to know what's going on in legal, I would look at the topics that people are talking about.
That's right. You can't go wrong. Even looking at some of the titles and just brief summaries, you could get a lot of knowledge about what's happening right now in 2024 in the legal recruiting and law school world.
That's right. So if you could look back over all the conferences that you've attended, that you've contributed to, which one stands out as the most memorable?
Wow. It's really hard to pick a favorite. I would say there's a lot of great people and friends that I've met throughout the process and all of them. I think coming off of the Keystone Conference, planning the Toronto Conference was terrific. We had great, amazing weather and people got their passports and came over and experienced Canada. You know, our members in Canada were very involved in that as well. That's kind of a highlight. There's just really been so many throughout the years. The Tampa Planning Committee really has generated so many future leaders, looking back at who is in the room with us and who has gone on to lead. And now so many of them were in the room when we were planning the Tampa conference. The Puerto Rico conference is a highlight just because I think people just look forward to that so much just to get out of Dodge. And it's
right.
Just the first time for many of us to go to Puerto Rico, and I have very fond memories of that as well.
And the New Orleans conference, wasn't that the first post-COVID conference?
Yes, I was involved in that as well. And the electricity in that city, just to have us back together. I mean, every time you come to a conference, there's so many people hugging and, you know, just reconnecting with people that they may only see in person once a year. It's just so fun. And
yeah,
Everyone really looked forward to that. And the planning team and Jessica just really knocked that one out of the park. It was just fabulous and a great city for the sort of vibe that we had. We were just so excited to be back together.
It was such an easy vibe, such an easy conference to go to. And it was, people were excited to get out.
They very much were.
Yeah. And I'm always amazed at how much business gets done in terms of building relationships, just walking around the trade show floor and meeting all the vendors and other people like that.
That's right. We spend a lot of time catering to and including newcomers to the profession and to the conference. I think we have hundreds of folks who said that this was their first or second conference this year, and we welcome them. We had an orientation last year and gave them some tips. There was a webinar that happened earlier this month, and really encouraged them to get to know each other so that in future conferences, they can look for each other and they will learn and grow so much just from the contacts that they make at a conference.
That's great. And so the webinar, was that for new attendees?
It was. Yes, that was earlier in April.
And you know, it's interesting when you walk into a room full of strangers, I think everybody feels a bit of anxiety. And I like the fact that NALP takes care so that people don't have to feel that way when they come here. And you mentioned you had a newcomers webinar. What are some other things that NALP does to make newcomers feel welcome?
Sure. At the orientation last night, we had some kind of things where they could meet people at the table and introduce each other. And then as a group, we offered to walk down to the vendors and kind of introduce them around to the things to expect when they're here. And so hopefully, you know, we have the Join Us table tents so that people can join us at lunch and breakfast and know that they're welcome. They don't have to feel awkward just sitting down at a table because everyone's very welcoming. But we make it a point to be very intentional about including everyone.
Yeah, it's great. It's one of the few places in the world you can just come down to a table and introduce yourself to someone and ask them where they're from, what they do, and you build relationships that can last the rest of your career.
Right. I think we are better together and we do share. And, you know, it's so much fun to see. In fact, at lunch today, I was sitting with folks from Canada and their issues may be a little different than our issues in the U.S. legal profession. But we all can come together and kind of share and understand each other very well based on the common themes.
Absolutely right. And what would your recommendations for people that want to get involved in contributing to the next few conventions and conferences? What would you recommend to them?
Well, I think if you're ready, by all means, submit an RFP for consideration for the Cleveland event. If you're not ready to do that, you can get involved in a section. Most people start off by picking the newcomers section, although you can also get a specialty section. And you'd be surprised that you know more than you think you know, and you can offer to write an article for any of our communications. You can present, you can do a webinar. If you have an idea, find someone else who might want to do that, or just pitch the idea and the NALP staff and the sections will help you get that together with other folks. You don't even have to know your other speakers. So whatever you want to do, I think, you know, dip your toe in the water or just dive right in. NALP has something for you.
That's great, Sibel. Thanks so much for your time being on the show. And thanks for all of your contributions to the association.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Hey, this is Scott Love with the NALP podcast, NALP Talk. We've got our guest today, Kara Harden, who's the lead executive officer with the Practice Lab. Kara, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott. I'm excited to be here.
Right, right. And to our listeners, you may recognize her name and even her voice because she spoke at the NALP conference in Boston recently. And Kara, tell us about your experience at NALP. Had you ever spoken at NALP before? And what was your experience like in Boston meeting everybody?
It was, so first I have to say, when you said they might recognize my voice, I had this daydream all of a sudden that I was like a radio talk show host.
Right.
That you might hear me giving your traffic report on the way into work. NALP has a very special place in my heart. I work in my business. It's me and my husband. And so NALPers are the closest thing I have to colleagues.
Yeah. I like NALPers. Yeah.
And so it's a really community-based, encouraging, welcoming, warm conference where I get to share the trends and ideas that I've been seeing and thinking the most about over the course of the last year.
Yeah,
it's really one of the highlights of the year for me.
And I can see how your topic, which we'll get into here in a little bit, aligns very well with the spirit of that group. I've been to a lot of conferences. I've never been to one just like the NALP people. I was talking with Tony Waller, the past president. I said, it's kind of like this is a conference for people that if they didn't do this, they'd be social workers. They've got a lot of heart.
Right.
And so tell me about the topic title. Where do you specialize in terms of your speaking? And what did you talk about at the last NALP conference?
So the session was on radical striving. And so I work with a group of people I call strivers. Strivers are people who feel most safe, secure, and connected when they're meeting or exceeding expectations. So oftentimes in our performance-driven, productive work culture, we see folks as high-achieving, high performing, over functioning, perhaps mm-hmm. might be a word that we lean into quite a bit. And I found that that language was insufficient and ambiguous. I don't know what it meant. It was very externalized. So for example, you bring in a new book of business, you roll out a new EAP plan, you develop a new like overarching systemic competency-based model. Does that make you a high achiever? Does that make you a high performer? It was all outcome-based. And in my private psychotherapy practice and my consulting work, what I found were people showing up feeling anxious, inadequate, lonely, and lost,
yeah,
whether they were getting the results or not. So I started to sort of peel back the layers and realize that what has happened over time is we've learned to associate our value, our worth, our safety, security, and connection in the world, our feeling inside that things are okay and things are right, with when we're meeting expectations, ideally when we're exceeding them. So my session was called Radical Striving because I'm in the process of developing, researching, and thinking about a new way of engaging and relating to work that is separate from meeting or exceeding expectations.
So how would you define it, the current situation, when people, they just don't feel comfortable unless they're meeting or exceeding? Is there a definition or a description of that?
It's more of a sensation. So Scott, accept, reject, counteroffer. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. When was the last time you felt really off, like kind of not okay inside?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say probably in the last week or so, you know?
Yeah. And when you think about the context around that, how do you understand what was making you feel uneasy?
It was not having clarity in terms of a business decision, where it was, should I go here or here? Gosh, I don't know what to do. I'm feeling a little bit off. I wasn't feeling as confident as I normally feel.
Right. And so what I make up about that is there was not just a lack of clarity, but also an ambiguity as to who you were supposed to be.
Yes.
Which part of your identity were you going to put forward?
Yeah, right.
Part of you, right. And oftentimes we feel most off when that conflict pulls on two parts of our identity. And so I don't have a word yet for what it's like when we are not meeting that expectation, but the experience you've just described, that's it. And I know that NALPers, and I hope that the people listening, they themselves can now ask the question, okay, well, when was the last time I was feeling not like myself or off or bothered, not at? And what was happening for me? What hidden expectation did I have of myself? What way did it pull at my identity? And that's how you know you're striving. In that moment, there is a part of you that feels like, uh-oh, I've got to show up right. I've got to show up in a way that people are going to like me. I've got to show up accurate. I can't ruffle any feathers. That's the way we've been taught to handle these decisions. And anything less than that feels really unsafe. It makes our whole body go, uh-oh, like, what's wrong?
Yeah, right. Do we get over that? Can we get over that? Should we get over that? Yeah.
Right. Great question. Do you still feel off?
I don't. I got clarity in what I need to do. And I think that feeling subsided. And I think I hear the point is that we shouldn't let these external things dictate how we feel, which is interesting because that's a lesson I had, was telling my son. He was trying to fly out from LA a couple of days ago. He literally had 7 delays for his flight. The resolution was they gave him a taxi voucher to go from Burbank to Santa Ana to get on another flight, a 2-hour taxi ride. And he's all upset. And I told him, I said, you have a choice in how you respond to this. What can you learn? What if this was the best thing that happened to you? What if this episode gave you insight into something else? And so even I shared with him a mantra that I personally use, that I choose not to let external circumstances govern how I feel. And I think even though you know that, and you know this, Kara, when you're in it, boy, it's really hard to manage those emotions, right?
Not only that, it's hard to know when it's an external expectation. Because oftentimes, from a very young age, we've internalized the standard. And so let's think about you are making a business decision between A and B.
Yep.
If from a very young age, the world around you said A is prestigious, A is status, A is wealth, business decision A will make you important and valuable. And business decision B was something that was like, okay, less status, less wealth, less influence. As you are making the decision and trying to find clarity, it's going to be really hard to understand, oh, am I compelled to A because it's my preference, because it's my interest, because it excites me? Or is it because I was programmed and conditioned to find A really attractive? And so I often think that what the work is recognizing all of the different influences that are constantly at play, and then thinking about the parts of us. You know, you were saying that, you know, is the answer to have clarity around what you need to do? I think the answer is having clarity around how are the parts of you feel.
Yeah,
interesting. How all the parts of you are conceptualizing and approaching what is in front of you, and then knowing your priorities. That may or may not result in an action. So if we make it really tangible again, so you're deciding between A and B, and I'm going to make up that there's part of you who's a dad who is like, oh my gosh, it would be such great role modeling if I did A, and it would set my family up for A. And then there's another part of you that's this podcast professional, this recruiter that works with all of these rainmakers and high-powered people. And they're like, oh, but A, like I'm a little burned out.
Yeah.
I don't know if A is great for me. And then there's another part of you that's like interested in all of these other things outside of work. So it's understanding all of those parts and how they see the decision. And from there going, huh, okay. So I have all these parts about A. What are all of the parts of me thinking about B? And from there, is there clarity around what my preference would be in the short and long term?
So let me ask you this question, Kara, and I appreciate what you've mentioned. That makes a lot of sense. You mentioned the work is recognizing all the influences constantly at play. And how do we do that? How do we parse those? Is it through journaling? Is it through working with the coach or counselor? What do you think? How do we really tangibly define all those?
So there's lots of different ways. And if you're listening, a listener is listening, and they're thinking, great question, Scott. My first idea back is, do you have an instinct for yourself? Is there a therapist you already have? Is there a coach you already have? Is there a mentor? Is there a 5-minute journal? Like, is there a place where you're already doing this work that you intuitively are drawn to? If so, you are the expert on you. That is the place to go. If this is the first time you've heard these ideas and Scott's question is exactly like, oh my gosh, Kara, like throw me like a lifeline, throw me a preserver, because now I feel like I'm drowning and I'm overwhelmed with options and ideas. I have an exercise that I like to encourage clients to do, and I call it the responsibility pie.
Oh,
I
like the responsibility pie, right? Okay, good.
Yes. Good. Yes. So I like for mine to imagine it being a cherry pie, both because the inner's ooze, but some people really like pizza because the cheese strings. So like whatever pie, and it's a circle. And what I want us to notice is, as really high achievers, high performance strivers, as I call us, when things happen in our lives, the story we tell ourselves is, I am responsible and in control of the entire pie in front of me. I have a decision I have to make about A or B. Every part of this context is my own to own. When in reality, you always need to give a slice of the pie to context. What's happening in the world? Are podcasts taking off? Are they not taking off? Are there opportunities in other spaces? So broadly speaking, you have to ask yourself, well, what's happening around me in my life? Another piece of the pie goes to history and all the isms, you know, patriarchy, white supremacy, ableism, neurotypicalism, all the ways that we are taught as society that people have differentiated value, because that's also going to play in to how you conceptualize your value, whether you realize it or not. Mm-hmm. The number of times I casually will say, oh, there's the patriarchy having me like negotiate down my value, or, oh, there's the patriarchy, I feel bad I didn't put makeup on before this podcast. Like, isms get slices of the pie. And then you, of course, do get accountability, responsibility. That's where we think about preferences, values, integrity, dignity. And then oftentimes other people in your life will get a piece of the pie as well. And so going through and assigning as much context and relevance to your experience as you possibly can is something you could do individually. If you find you keep making a pie and it looks exactly the same and it's not giving you the sense of clarity inside, then engaging with a professional can really help, because at best, a therapist, a coach, they're just a really good mirror. They're really good at helping you see your parts in ways that you perhaps may not be used to seeing them,
right?
And can really help draw them out. A good friend could do it too. You know, you get to be the expert on where you seek that clarity and support.
That's great. Kara, let me ask you this. Tell me about someone that you've worked with. You don't have to mention their name, of course, but what was the challenge they had before related to this issue? What were the action steps that they took, how you advised them, and how did what was the payoff? How did they grow through this and benefit from this?
Yeah. So I'm going to do the Law and Order, all names and changes.
Right.
Action. Moment, but an amalgamation. There is one client that particularly comes to mind, and they showed up at my office because they, in their own words, were profoundly burnt out. They were a senior associate, but you could sub in learning development specialist, HR manager, partner, junior, law student, accountant. You can sub in any function. The symptoms were not being able to put work down, but also feeling dread about work, feeling guilty and miserable when they were working, guilty and miserable when they weren't working. There was a profound apathy that they were developing. The point?
Yeah.
Their decisions were starting to leak into either I'm staying or I'm going. Like everything started to feel like an either or. In the greater context of their life, they were having fertility struggles and trying to get pregnant. They had complicated family dynamics with family living out of country and needing to have caregiver responsibilities. They also were extremely successful in their group and found that they were most successful because they were constantly responsive. And so a lot of the work in the beginning started with physically regulating their body. So the body tells the brain more than the brain tells the body. Your brain lives in a black box inside your head. Every single piece of data your brain gets comes from your body. And when your body has been clenching and vigilant and on guard for years, sometimes decades, it's really hard to think clearly. It's hard to, like, I don't know how you look at a responsibility pie if your body is constantly bracing for the next trauma or drama. And so part of the work just started. And so what that involved is figuring out a way for her to comfortably start moving. It started with standing up at their desk. Like they would stand up and be at their desk and they would sway back and forth because this is a busy transactional associate. They have family demands. Like they're not going to lift weights 5 times a week. And then it did start though with putting weights on their wrist as they were working. So in very small ways, starting to take walking calls, like incorporating movement, figuring out a sleep routine, like really trying to figure out a way to get her body to feel less threatened. And then from there, there was constant responsibility pies. So even as I explain the context, I hope people are listening and they can hear in themselves, oh, this person had demands in their family. They had demands in their own inside between wanting to be a parent or the demands of future parenthood. They had work, professional, collegial responsibilities. They had ideas about what made them successful that they were bringing to the conversation that came both from their developmental experiences as well as from societal expectations, as well as their own ambition. And then over time, we were able to identify all of these different parts. And the result has been profound agency, so that when work is calling, when a parent is calling, when friends are calling, when there's babies that need help, thank goodness the person had babies, they're able to say, okay, so 8 different parts of me are being activated right now. I am but one resource. This is really painful. I need to focus on work. Or this is really painful. I need to focus on my family. And I'm going to soothe and manage the discomfort of the parts of me that are unsatisfied. I'm going to trust that it was the decision I needed. And I'm going to build a life that is reflective of my heart. I'm going to pick myself and the part that I lead with again and again and again.
Wow, Kara, that's great. That's profound. And it's also inspiring. Are there any trends that you think we should look for in our lives to where we know that something's off? Are there any indicators or tells that we should pay attention to?
You know, I love the question. And also, interestingly enough, my brain just did this thing. The result of the work this person did, this amalgamation of many people, but the result often actually looks like all the things that productivity gurus, so to speak, will tell you. Like, it did result in them saying no more often. It did result in them developing a meditation practice. They are lifting heavy weights regularly. Like, it ends up looking a lot like, quote unquote, what is recommended. It just comes from such a different place. It's a different process. It's not, I need to feel better, so I'm going to lift weights.
Yeah.
It's this whole different process.
Are there any indications that we should pay attention to that tell us?
Thank you.
Here's a little bell that's going off. I need to pay attention to this.
Yeah. So it's why I sort of did the session at NELP is 4 years ago when COVID was newest. I don't want to say scariest, but it was at a really terrifying point.
Yeah.
I would be in meetings with people who were doing contact tracing as they were dropping their kids off at school, who were the ones in charge of enforcing office days, out of office days, mask mandates, checking on vaccines, like people who were in this really painfully thorny professional role at that was reflected in their personal tension, pain, thorniness. Like no matter how you felt about what the world was experiencing, professionally, you had obligations to show up a certain way. And no matter what was happening professionally, personally, you had obligations to show up a different way. And what I saw again and again is people, and I did it myself, people ratcheting up. So, you know, in a roller coaster where it goes click, 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 that's the emotional equivalent of what I saw. It was challenge, rise, challenge, rise, challenge, rise. And whenever we get into that gear, that's, and it takes hold of us, that's one of the things where I'm like, okay, this is going to be really painful, but you need to get off the ride. Like you need to find a way to not be climbing up this roller coaster, because that's often when we pull the responsibility pie back, when we're moving into a power through. I just have to get through this. I just have to see this through. I have to power through this experience. It will be better in 2 weeks. Scott, when school is done, I'll rest. When summer is done, I'll rest. I'll rest when this is, when we get to that place, it's our body going, bing, 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 bing. I need a new tool. I need something else. So noticing in you, whatever that click, 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 and the drive, the feeling that you are only safe if you keep going. So for example, if you're listening right now and you're like, cool, 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 Kara, I feel that click, click, but the thing that's going to make me feel better is if I send this email. The thing that's going to make me feel better is if I finish this project, I launch this learning program. The thing that's going to make me feel better is this work-related thing. The thing that will make me feel better is working harder. It's a sign
that
you are leaning into your striver to get through something when perhaps you need to call on a different part of yourself. In the way that if you are trying to sort through a really naughty problem, like a gnarly one, and you take a shower, you like step away from it, or you go for a walk, and then you come back to it, it's resolved. I'm asking you to call on that same gear shift. Yeah. And so almost making things easier on yourself for a little while so that you can see a more efficient pathway through, and also so that you can be crafting a life that's more meaningful to you.
That's profound, Kara. This is really profound. And I think in today's world, I think that even talking about mental health, I think COVID was an inflection point where we saw how deep we all had to go immediately together. I've even noticed, just because I told you I went to the Naval Academy in the 1980s and there was no mental health. It was just power through it. Keep your head down. And I've noticed now even conversations with some of my guy friends that I hang out with, my golfing buddies, when I go to New York and we go to the oyster bar and drink martinis and eat oysters, I'm able to have a deeper level of conversation with them because we went through something together. And I think there is that benefit from that. And I think that mental health, people talk about this now. I don't think that has the stigma. I think oversharing on social media, you got to watch that, I think, a little bit. But I think that when people can talk about issues like this, that we are in a professional workplace. I don't think you saw much of that before. What do you think?
So there's two things I want to hit on from what you're saying, which I really appreciate you sharing. The first is, what was in the 90s stress management and the aughts resilience is now mental health and well-being training. There has been a profound evolution in our willingness to address and speak to these topics. And that evolution has even more advancement and progress and room. If you think about what's happening in the UK, like one thing I'm very passionate about is like organizations need to be addressing menopause meaningfully. They need to address and be educating around the hormonal sort of life changes that are happening right when women are at the peak of their career and they're getting brain fog and they're feeling like, what is happening? So there's advancement, but you are 100% right. The other thing that I think is so important, what you're saying, beyond just destigmatization, mm-hmm. a decrease in stigma, though there's stigma that still exists, is for the longest time, especially for men, tough was logic. Mm-hmm. Tough was rationality. Tough was distance. And their female friends and partners played the role of connection, played the role of emotional regulation. And in a world where there is a loneliness epidemic, according to the former U.S. Surgeon General, relationships are the most protective factor for our mental health. But the yeah. only way you can truly relate to someone is if you are talking in a way where you know you will be seen, heard, and valued. So yeah. being able to go for oysters and say, I'm really low. Yeah. And I'm struggling.
Yeah.
And know that your friends are going to say more, as opposed to, God, you just need what? Like, your wife isn't being kind enough to you in that super heteronormative kind of way. Know that you won't be dismissed and like, back up. Like,
yeah.
Like being able to open up and feel seen, heard, and mattered, that is protective.
It is.
That's protective.
I love it. I love that the world is kind of, I wouldn't say softened up, but become more aware and real. And that sometimes it's not easy. And I want to thank you for your expertise, for sharing that with us on the show, Kara, for your involvement in NALP. And tell us about how can people reach out to you? What's your website if people want to reach out yes. to you and talk to you more about this?
Yes. So I do a ton of my thinking out loud on LinkedIn. I am passionate about creating impact and sharing my ideas. I am a work in progress. I think one of the really cool things about what I do and why I call the organization the Practice Lab is because I am practicing high performance. I'm practicing running a mental health training and education business at a time when mental health has, you know, it's as popular as it's ever been. And I'm trying to do it while relating to work in such a way that all the parts of me get to belong. And so please follow me on LinkedIn, and not only follow me, but comment, engage, counter offer, accept, reject what I say. It's funny to me sometimes that I'm a professional speaker, because I think first and foremost, I'm actually just a professional listener. And I have the privilege, honor, and joy of hearing people and witnessing them growing and changing and aspiring to become more of themselves. And across all channels, as often as I can be, that's my happiest place. And so you do me a great honor when you engage with me on social. And that's where I'd find me.
Well, thank you, Kara. I know I'll be following you, and I'm sure other people listening to the show will as well. Thanks so much, Kara. Great job.
Thanks, Scott. And thanks, Z, for the edits.
Thank you for listening to this episode of NALP Talk. For more information about our association, including research and statistics, educational information and conferences, resources, and other initiatives, visit our website at nalp.org.